Welcome to The Other Side of the Plate, brought to you by Feast, families empowered and supporting treatment of eating disorders. This podcast is for moms, dads, and caregivers searching for answers, the kind that can feel so hard to find when your loved one has an eating disorder. I'm Jenny, and along with my co-host Laura, we're here as caregivers with lived experience who supported our loved ones through an eating disorder. Together, we'll share personal insights, connect you with professionals, and point you toward helpful resources. And as we say at Feast, we're here because we've been there. The content contained in this podcast is not a substitute for professional or medical treatment, and it may not represent the views and beliefs of Feast. Always consult a medical professional for medical advice and treatment recommendations.
Hello, and welcome back to The Other Side of the Plate. My name is Laura Cohen. I'm here with my co-host, Jenny Gaines. And we have a very special guest today, one that is near and dear to my heart, mainly because, a little fun fact, Amy Boyers is our guest, Dr. Amy Boyers. And Amy and I have known each other since the summer before second grade. So just, you know, we have a lot of history here. I promised her I wouldn't embarrass her, but I can try. But we go way, way, way back. So it's really fun when I was like, okay, we got to get Dr. Boyers. I can't even call you Dr. Boyers.
No, don't.
Like, that's just weird.
Yeah, please don't.
So I was really excited to ask Amy, you know, personally, professionally, to be able to join our podcast because I know that Amy has a lot to offer. So on that note, I'm going to tell you a little bit about Amy and then give her the mic. So Dr. Amy Boyers is the co-founder and president of Galen Hope, which is a physician-led program providing eating disorder and mental health treatment for adolescents and adults across a wide range of diagnoses. It's based in South Florida, and they serve clients from across the United States. Dr. Boyers has been in private practice in Miami since 2001, and she provides therapy to adolescents and adults with a focus on women's health, eating disorders, anxiety, mood disorders, and behavioral medicine. Amy graduated from University of Pennsylvania, where she was awarded a prestigious U.S. Department of Defense Psychological Research Fellowship at the University of Miami, which brought her back home because we grew up in Miami, where Amy completed her master's and doctoral degrees. Amy is also the adjunct faculty at the University of Miami Counseling Center, and she has spoken locally and nationally, which I see her all over the place when I'm on Instagram, on the topics of eating disorders, stress, trauma, and adolescent development. Amy, welcome.
Thank you.
So let's start it off easy. Tell us how you got involved in eating disorder treatment, because I actually don't 100% even know that story.
Oh, sure. So it was something that I had always really wanted to get into. I found it just really fascinating. And in growing up in the 80s, there was definitely awareness of eating disorders. You remember there was the Steve Levenkron book, Best Little Girl in the World. And I'm sure that was like an after school special at some point. So, I recall some awareness that there were some girls that had eating disorders, but it was very taboo to talk about. I certainly didn't know how you got treatment for that, but I knew I was really interested in it. And when I was doing my internship as part of my PhD, a treatment center opened up in Coral Gables. And I decided to pursue that. And I worked there. And then shortly thereafter, I went into private practice. And I wound up going into the office space of a therapist who I had shared a case with when I worked at the treatment center. And I called him one day and I was like, I'm looking for office space. Do you know anybody? He's like, I have office space. And I wound up moving into the office of two men who were two of the first people really in the country to treat eating disorders. And they were psychoanalysts and they were brothers, Roy and Elliot Ehrlichman. Elliot died a while back. And Roy was one of the founders of IADEP. And so I got to some additional training with them. Every week we would meet and discuss cases. And so for, I don't know, probably 8 to 10 years, I had like weekly psychoanalytic eating disorder training from people who had been doing it for like 40, 50 years. And then I got more integrated into the eating disorder space. I then was a consultant for the Oliver Pyatt Center. That's where I met my co-founder for Galen Hope, Wendy Oliver Pyatt, and she and I created the Clementine program together. And so just sort of one foot in front of the other, one project led to another. And then I approached Wendy one day and said, I think I have an idea for a treatment center. And would you like to give it a try? And so here we are. All this time later. Yeah.
I remember when my daughter was in treatment, Amy saying to me, yeah, well, I'm opening up a treatment center. And the timing wasn't right exactly, but it was one of those like worlds colliding. But I didn't really introduce what we're going to talk about today. So I think it's a perfect segue of getting into it since, you know, you were talking about how, you know, back in the 80s, you know, when we grew up, and I mean, we could probably spend 5 podcast episodes talking all about that and diet culture and just knowing people who had eating disorders and, you know, in high school, and just we didn't know what to do, right? And then going into that field, and then think about what people's experience was in the 80s and the 90s with treatment. And then we're going to talk about today, FBT, family-based treatment with a twist. And FBT wasn't something that anyone knew about in the 80s and 90s.
When I did my training, let's see. So that was like around 2000. Even at that point, the attitude was, give us your child. Let us work with them. Please move out of the way. And we will give them back to you. And even then, I had awareness that this wasn't working.
Yeah.
I was very new to the field. But when FBT came out, I was an early adopter because it made so much sense to me. So even if FBT isn't something your family can do, there's a lot of principles and the spirit of FBT, I feel, really should be present in many ways, even at a higher level of care. And I think we do that really well at Galen Hope. We have something called the family integration model, where it's intentional. It's the expectation of our program that parents are going to be included deeply and they're expected to show up. And so that's a principle borrowed from FBT for sure. Yeah.
I love that. So what I'm hearing you say is, you know, back in the 80s and the 90s, basically the patients would get a parentectomy. I've heard that before, like parents move out of the way, we're removing it. And then comes an FBT. But a lot of listeners listen, because I like to talk about our listeners. A lot of our listeners may be new to this. And really, we're talking about FBT, but we know what it is. But can you just give a brief explanation of what is FBT? And also, what does quote unquote true FBT look like in practice?
So like the first version of family-based treatment really took place in London at Maudsley Hospital. And sometimes you'll hear people use the term Maudsley. They'll say, I did Maudsley. And the truth is they are slightly different. What they did at Maudsley Hospital was a little more free-flowing, and it was actually a multi-family-based intervention. But they were on to something about really teaching the families how to manage the eating disorder at home. And then Locke and LaGrange brought that over to the United States, and they manualized it and standardized it. And that's what FBT is here. Family-based treatment here in the United States is based on a structured, manualized intervention that has lots of research behind it. It was originally developed for families with adolescents with anorexia nervosa. And over the years, they've expanded that to even working with young adults and other eating disorder diagnoses like bulimia and binge eating disorder. And it's really an intensive model, working outpatient with a therapist who's trained in FBT to teach the family how to manage the weight restoration, manage the behaviors at home. And there's 3 phases to the treatment. And it sort of also develops a developmental model where in the beginning, when the child is more impaired, the parents step in a more active way. Phase two, they begin to transfer some responsibility for feeding over to the child. And stage three is very short. It's really a kind of wrapping up and then transitioning into more traditional psychotherapy. But really, they say laser-like focus on weight restoration. And it's very behavioral. It's very kind of nutritionally focused. And while you do implement certain psychological tools or intervention, they're all in service of eliminating the eating disorder and blocking the eating disorder. Unlike traditional family therapy, it doesn't really get into problem dynamics. It says, basically, it's very empowering of the families, and that any family is capable of doing this, and that it really moves away from that stigmatization that was happening earlier. I mean, in many ways, it was a response to feeling pushed out by treatment professionals. And so there was this big swing when FBT came out that was very anti-establishment treatment, and for good reason, because parents were demonized. You know, and you think about all of that talk about the enmeshed mother and that concept, which doesn't even really hold up in the research. And so, I think it was a really necessary development. FBT, not only as a tool for families, but for the field, I think it really brought in an attitude of egalitarianism, where parents are treated as experts on their own children and on their own family, and that the professional has technical skill, but that you have to find a way to implement this in a way that's consistent with the way your family operates. And I just always found doing it really fun. You get to know these families really well. Everyone does it a little differently. When I did FBT in private practice, I would go into the home and do the meals with the families. And so, you know, that just gave me a window into their world that otherwise I wouldn't have. And, you know, when the child emerges on the other end better, that's a really, really nice experience to have together, because you're all in it together.
Yeah. I remember when I heard what FBT was, I was like, that just makes so much sense. You know, it's essentially tasking the caregivers, the parents, like whoever the caregivers may be, the supports, to re-nourish their child in their home, not hopefully not having to go somewhere. And it, to me, I was like, well, that does make sense. Then the first thing is, let's get them out of the house. So thank you for that.
Yeah. And there's times where getting someone out of the house might be appropriate. And I think that's a complex clinical question and a hard one for anyone to answer. When is that appropriate and when is it not?
That really is a complex question. I think every parent is looking for the quote right treatment, and it can be hard to decide what that is. There's such a learning curve when your child is diagnosed with an eating disorder. Amy, how do you go about guiding families to decide where to start with treatment, and how do you help them make changes to treatment if that's what's needed?
Yeah, I think that anytime I ever worked with a family, I informed them, okay, this is what's going on. Your child has an eating disorder. Here's the diagnosis. Here's what I think is going on. And here are your options. And let me go through the pros and cons of all the options for you. And certainly for a family for whom this is new, these behaviors began recently. This is really the first time you've been working with a mental health professional, or you haven't been working with one very long, I think FBT is a really sensible and reasonable choice. It keeps the family together. It keeps the child at home. But you do need to really understand what that process involves. And I have seen families where it absolutely was not realistic, even though those circumstances were present. It was a fairly new eating disorder. This was a young teen. These were concerned parents who were showing up, but the relationship between the parents and the child was so tumultuous and so tense. This child was unwilling to accept support from her parents, and she was acting out and kind of running away and very, very angry. And she didn't stay in my practice long enough for me to find out why she was so angry, but the anger and the rage was so intense that it was impossible for her to sit in the same room as her parents. And so and they were also feeling like there's no way we can do this. I, of course, presented it to them, but they recognized that the relationship was too fragile and they just weren't in a place where, and that was not really a result of the eating disorder. I think there's times when someone's in the throes of an eating disorder and it completely messes up the relationship with the family, but that wasn't the case here. That would predated the eating disorder. I have seen situations where there may be a parent who's pretty severely impaired in some way. Sometimes the other parent can do it. It depends on the impact that one parent's impairment is having on the whole family system and the finances and all that stuff. So sometimes that can be a problem. I have seen some parents who have their own trauma history and who were just very sensitive to the level of chaos and upset that comes with trying to do refeeding.
Yeah.
And it triggers them. And so it's that overwhelms them. They may have their own responses to conflict that prevent them from being able to do it. And the problem is a lot of people don't always have awareness of that. If you haven't been in therapy yourself, if you haven't recognized that what you've been through is traumatic and that it may be playing out now, that can be a real problem because the low level of awareness that you're having a trauma response every time your child gets dysregulated. And we know that's going to happen. I mean, we know that attempting to implement FBT is going
to be hard.
Yeah, it's going to be upsetting. And no amount of explaining that to parents is going to prepare them for that. Some parents are like, I don't care, scream away. Like, we're getting this done. And some parents go into a full-on trauma response. And then the eating disorder just walks all over them. I think if you have, and again, if you've done your work, if you have awareness, if you know what your trauma response is and you can manage it, and maybe you have some other support in your life, like a husband or a wife or whatever, who can help you through those moments, then you probably will be fine. But if you don't have that awareness, that can be really, really problematic. I see you nodding along. What are you thinking about, Laura?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And I was thinking one thing I really like what you were saying is one reason to bring in someone who understands FBT, which hopefully people do, right? I mean, yes, you can do it on your own and all of that. But I love that you, as the therapist who is trained in FBT, were able to look at the family dynamic and be like, this isn't going to work because...
Yeah.
And some other options, because I think that bringing that professional in is so, so important. And also sometimes parents think that they can't do it and they're scared to do it and they actually can, right? And working with the correct team to help manage the caregiver's emotions and their own distress tolerance is huge. I'm a heck of a lot better caregiver, human person, empathetic, whatever, from doing FBT and learning all of those skills myself. But definitely having that trained therapist is so, so important because you don't want to give up too soon. And if it's not right, then it's not right. And that's okay.
Yeah.
And I think that's great for the listeners to hear too, in case they're in one of those situations. If you're told this is the gold standard treatment, FBT, 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 and for whatever reason, you don't have access to an FBT therapist, it's not good for your family dynamic, as Amy explained, or some other reason that there are other options and you don't need to feel like you're missing out on the quote best option.
Yeah, I mean, that idea of gold standard, it's only the gold standard if it works for you. If it doesn't work for you, then, I mean, and I feel like that just makes people feel like they're failing when there's so many ways to get there. And I also think that people shouldn't feel pressured to accept any course of treatment in the moment. Like, you're allowed to take these recommendations home with you, do your research, think about it, come back a week later, talk about it some more. You don't have to make that decision right then and there. I think that unless there really is medical acuity that's so dangerous that, like, you've got to act now, but you can take a minute. And I think it's really important to go and do your research. I mean, I know Feast has lots of information available for people who are considering FBT so that you can get a flavor of what it's going to be like for you. It's no joke.
Yeah.
It's a big undertaking, and you've got to be ready to set aside a lot of aspects of your life for a little while to do this.
Yeah.
And I think most parents would do it without thinking, because that's the parental instinct and that's our tendencies as parents, is if I can do something to save my child, throw myself in front of a car or bus, whatever, I'll do it to save my child. But there are options out there for everyone. They're really, I think we're at a really interesting point in terms of the field, that people have lots of access to information, some good and some not as good, but there are also a lot of treatment options now. And you should do your homework into really thinking about what's going to work best for your family.
Yeah. What would you say? I mean, you touched upon some of this about different families that it may or may not work for, that FBT may not be a good fit, and come up with all the obvious. But if you had to put it in a nutshell, where would you see the common reasons that families either struggle or stall with an FBT? And I definitely want to get into other options as well and other modalities as well.
I think a lot of families are good candidates, and I think people should try it. If you're interested in it, you should try it. I think that's a reasonable choice. I think the older the child, especially if they're in their 20s, it can be a little more challenging, especially if that person has lived independently and now the parents are stepping in a way that's developmentally a little bit back from where they are. That can be really hard for that child, that adult child, to accept that. I have seen some young adults do it with their parents, and it's been great. But if they have been living with a lot of independence and freedom, that's going to be a tough one. Where I have seen families fall off or stall is in a couple of places. One is it gets really hard and it's going on for a really long time, and the eating disorder is still finding ways to beat the system and get in there, that they're not catching all the behaviors. So the eating disorder is getting kind of emboldened and reinforced because the child's been able to continue to engage in eating disorder behaviors at the same time that the parents are making a concerted effort to beat it back. Mm-hmm. And so they have figured out, how do I sneak around my parents? How do I?
They're so smart.
Yeah. And so if the parents can't wrap their arms around that and really implement effective consequences for that, I think that can get people stuck. And that's where sometimes that can even go further into like enabling, when mm-hmm. parents struggle to tolerate their child's distress, whether it's because you're asking them to eat and they don't want to, or because you're enforcing rules and expectations in a way that's new and different for the family. Because this is serious and parents get down to business and they're like not messing around. And that may feel really uncomfortable. And in any family system, when one part of the system changes the way they operate, the other parts of the system are going to do things to get them to change back. That's human nature. I want to go back
to the
status quo.
We need that quote right there.
And so the child will begin to engage in what I call change back behaviors. Go back to being the relaxed parent who let me get away with a lot of things, maybe not always so appropriate. I want you to go back to that. And they'll escalate certain behaviors until the parent will do it. And so that requires a certain amount of awareness. I think that's where having a trained clinician involved is helpful, to point that out to you, that this pattern is happening. I have seen people move into stage two too quickly with the returning of responsibility back to the child and not really watching enough time to make sure that the child really can handle that responsibility of feeding themselves again. I have seen parents also say that they're monitoring every meal and then it turns out they're not, and the kid's throwing breakfast or lunch away. And so that can, and if the parents can't fully commit to making sure that there is monitoring for every meal and snack, that means every meal and snack.
Yeah, exactly.
Because if that kid knows that mom is gonna get distracted on her phone or go to her computer and start working while I'm eating lunch, they know I'll performance eat breakfast because dad watches that, and then I'm gonna toss lunch. And so, you know, the consistency, some people struggle with the consistency of doing it every single time. I have seen some families who tend to eat, I would say, more clean, in a more dietetic fashion, struggle with the amount of food that is required, and they want to stick with foods that are like healthy foods. And that can be very reinforcing of everything that the eating disorder wants. You want to give me quinoa and grilled chicken and broccoli every day? Yeah. Fantastic. And I'm like, do you want your child to have to eat like two entire birds a day? Like, you are never going to get there if you're eating grilled chicken and steamed broccoli. Like, bring me the ice cream, please. Get some chocolate cake out here, please. Like, actually, on my personal website for my private practice, the blog that has the most traffic is the blog that shows foods for weight restoration.
Show notes. Show notes. Go on the show notes.
And then we have one at Galen Hope. We did it. We did an updated one. I went to Trader Joe's and I took pictures. Recently, I did this and we posted it on the Galen Hope website too. Because sometimes it just requires you to buy food that normally you might not eat. And if you are a person who grew up in a time like we did, where foods were labeled as good and bad, or if you grew up in a family that really put a lot of emphasis on eating the right way, where you're putting kind of moral values on foods, it can be hard for you to load up your pantry and your refrigerator with those foods. And so that's going to prolong it. There is just no way you're going to get there with those kinds of foods. And it doesn't mean you can't eat them. And actually, that's an exercise that I've done with some people, is let's look at how much like salmon and quinoa you have to eat in order to calorically meet your needs. And let's do it my way, right? And it's like this mountain of food. Like, you have to eat so much of these foods. We've got to go for the denser foods. So some families really struggle with that. And that's where I think families get stuck, where I think a lot of it comes down to really implementing consequences consistently. When you catch a behavior of implementing appropriate consequences that have meaning to that child. So if you have a very studious, academically oriented child who refused to eat her dinner last night and threw a fit and did not complete her meal, why are you letting her go to school the next day?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In my mind, your brain and your body needs nutrition in order to make it through the day and in order for you to be successful at school. Why are you letting her go to her dance competition? Well, she practiced for it for the last 3 months. Yeah, I know. But if you really want her to know that you're serious about her recovery, you need to show her that you're willing to sacrifice even the dance competition or the prom or graduation, that you can go all the way, that you will go nuclear. And I think that's where a lot of families struggle, mm-hmm. is in giving up the things that they know are a source of pride and identity for that child.
But it's hard for the parent, right? The parent doesn't want to give that up because it's important for their pride too.
And it's really hard. And I'm sure there's parents here who are listening to this and thinking that's BS.
Exactly.
that you don't really understand my child and my child's level of achievement and how special they are and what's at risk and the college applications and the scholarships and all that. So your child has to survive and has to be healthy enough to be able to do that away from home. If they can't feed themselves and they can't take care of themselves, what good is it? Who cares? So that may sound kind of extreme, but that's the only way that you really can signal to the eating disorder, not to your child, but to the eating disorder, that you are willing to go as far as it takes to get this eating disorder out of your child's life and out of your family. And I think that can be, for so many of these families, these kids are so amazing and interesting and talented, and it's very hard to pull them out of these things, especially with all the pressure that children and families feel around college admissions. This can be very hard, or jobs, and they have this great job, this great internship, whatever it may be. But you have to be willing to say nothing is more important than your recovery. And people, parents absolutely feel that way, but sometimes their behaviors don't communicate that 100% of the time. And communicating that 90% of the time is not good enough. That 10% of the time that you flex and give in is keeping that door open for the eating disorder.
The eating disorder will find anywhere to wiggle in. And it's so hard. It's so hard as a parent. You know, Jenny and I are on the other side of the plate.
Exactly. I remember for me, I think one of the hardest things was accepting that my daughter, who you just described her, the one that's academic and talented and very high achieving, to look at her trajectory and see it may not be the way we always thought it was going to be. That was my work to do, to learn how to accept that. And it was extremely difficult. But listening to you talk about all the parts of FBT, I went through it, and it sounds overwhelming even now, and you know, in the aftermath. But I love FBT because it empowers parents, but it's also really intimidating. And I think some of us lose our confidence and we may give up too soon. So I wanted to ask you, if our child's we're going along, but our child's progress plateaus, maybe we're not gaining weight as quickly as we want to with FBT, or our child's health worsens, maybe their weight goes down and they start having some signals that their health is worse than it was. Are there any questions that parents could kind of ask themselves to evaluate or assess? Is it time for us to move on? Should we continue? Just as an assessment tool, maybe, for parents who are listening?
Look, plateaus happen. And I think that's where having really good communication with the team is important. A plateau isn't necessarily the end of the world. And I would engage the team. Okay, we're having a plateau. Her weight hasn't budged in 4 or 5 weeks. That's not great. And that's not great prognostically, right? Like, your team should be concerned about that. But I also think, just for me as a clinician, having seen all different types of therapists do this and being, you know, at this point on the more seasoned end of things, this is where it's really important to have a clinician who knows more than just FBT. You need to work with someone that you just think is a really strong therapist who has a lot of wisdom generally, because sometimes you need to step outside of the protocol for a minute. And maybe the parents need to come in and have a session where they just have a good cry with a therapist and they get some support for themselves. And we talk about what's been making it hard, and they can release some of those feelings and explore where this is coming from. And you do a regular therapy session, not an FBT session, but a real therapy session where they work through some stuff. And sometimes that's enough to get your energy back up, whatever was blocking you. You make some connections, you realize that where your responses are coming from, and you can get back on the saddle and you can do it again. And what I was trained on a million different manualized interventions throughout the course of my career. I think they're great for learning and they teach you a lot of tools as a therapist, but there is something called clinical intuition. And there is an art to doing any kind of therapy. And you need to be attuned as a clinician to what is going on with this child, with this family, with these parents. And you sometimes need to listen to yourself. Maybe mom and dad are going through something. Maybe there's another stressor in the family. It's not uncommon for families to come in with a parent, an older, like a grandparent who's not doing well. So at the same time that they are a caregiver for an elderly parent, they are dealing with this crisis with their children. And so sometimes you just need to give the parents a little love. Or sometimes maybe I need to give this kid a couple of just regular psychotherapy sessions so that I can increase her motivation to do this some more. Maybe they're getting burned out. So this is where your judgment as a clinician to address some of these side problems, it's not part of the protocol. You're not supposed to do that. But if I want to get there, and especially for some families, going to a treatment center is not financially viable. Their insurance doesn't cover it, or there isn't one that is appropriate nearby, or they have to make FBT work. Mm-hmm. They have to. Yeah. I have worked with families that have no other choice for a variety of reasons. If we have to make it work, then it's my job to figure out how do I get all these people to stay motivated and engaged and psychologically healthy throughout the process. And FBT does not provide you tools for that. And you've got to read the room and see what's going on with your people and give them the help they need.
So since we're talking, you're going to be talking right now to caregivers. Mm-hmm. What would you say to a caregiver who FBT isn't working for them? Yes, Lord willing, they've all got, you know, a therapist that has different modalities. Could you explain a couple of other options, a couple other modalities? Because our listeners may not know, right? They may only hear about FBT and nothing else. So what other things would you think would be helpful to introduce to caregivers?
Okay, well, I've done it a lot of different ways. I mean, first of all, we all know there's higher levels of care. There are treatment centers. I always, even with my FBT families, I always told them, listen, we're going to give this like maybe 4 to 8 weeks to work. If it doesn't work, we are not going to do this forever. And you need to have a plan B. What is your plan B? And that is not me expressing a lack of faith in them. It's really appropriate. We're going to try to make this work. If we can't get traction, we need to move on quickly, because otherwise you're going to get stuck here. And we'll talk about that, I guess. But what's your plan B? I have added dietitians. The original FBT did not involve even a dietitian. I almost always included the dietitian because I think parents just need that additional education around what your child needs. And then there's also higher levels of care. And so exploring, is there a program nearby? Do you know someone that went to a program? There are organizations that will refer you to programs. You can call your insurance. You talk to your pediatrician. A lot of times pediatricians are aware of programs that they've had some success with. So there's lots of different programs. There's virtual programs. And I know that there's a lot of conversation in FEAST, giving each other tips and support and just ideas of how to do it.
Yeah. I love when you said, you know, sometimes either the support or the patient just needs a regular old cry vent session, therapy session. Mm-hmm. Both. Yeah, one week we can be more therapeutic. One week we can, you know, just vent, and how helpful that can be too.
And that was all FBT with a twist. Everything you just described is, because when you're the parent, you're looking at the manualized FBT. If you don't have, like, if we don't have a therapist that is trained in all these other modalities or aware of all these other modalities, we're just like laser focused on FBT. So all of the different ways that they could continue with, like you called it, the spirit of FBT at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I think that's going to open up a lot of possibilities for the listeners, because I know for me, I did feel a lot of times like I was doing it wrong. Yeah. And so hearing you talk about just kind of creative ways to use, you are using your intuition, but caregivers can also use their intuition to make adjustments that you know will fit your child. Because as you said at the beginning, we're the experts on our kids. I think stepping into that responsibility is just a little bit daunting.
Yeah.
But it will be helpful to hear there are other options.
Yeah, I think hearing FBT is a relief in certain ways. And then it's also like, oh my God, what if I can't do it? Like now I've doubly failed because my kid has an eating disorder. So of course now I'm a failure as a parent. And now I tried to help them and that didn't work. So I must be a double failure now. And you know, to be honest, there's a lot of people out there that say they do FBT who are not formally trained in it. They're doing something that might resemble FBT. But check to make sure that the people you're working with have actual training, like actual training, not that they just read a book or went to like a 2-hour workshop. Like the training is real. And just because you're talking to parents about how to refeed their child, that is not FBT. FBT is a specific thing. I did many, many hours of training to do it. I did follow-up training on it. And there's actually some very interesting literature out there about, first of all, the literature on FBT now incorporates a lot of these twists that are actually being done out in the world. And so I really like that they're showing how adding certain things like a meal support coach and other types of coaching, how that improves outcomes and adding groups and things like that. But also, make sure that what you're getting is the real deal, because then the parents are stuck with this feeling like I just did something wrong. And it's like, no, it's like if you went to a doctor and you needed medication A and they gave you B and then you didn't get better, then is that your fault that you didn't get better? So it's meant to be done in a particular way. And I think it's fine to kind of riff and get creative, but you need to do it for the right reasons. You can't just be sloppy about it. It works based on the protocol that was developed. And if you're going to add services or mix it up in some way, you need to have a very coherent clinical understanding of why you're doing that. And so does the family. Okay, you all are struggling with cooking all these meals all the time. Let's get some prepared meals. Can grandma cook? Yeah, grandma loves to cook. I've had a lot. I mean, this is Miami, so we're with a lot of Cuban grandmothers who love to cook for the family and who do it anyway. And so, or can this, do mom and dad need a respite? Can we bring grandma in so that we can train grandma on how to do some meal support also, so mom and dad can take a break because they're starting to like lose it? So there's lots of ways to do that and get creative with the family that way.
I think about, you know, supporting, you know, when I went through, and I'm sure Jenny can agree, and we went through this with in our own house, you don't get a lot of support outside the house. You know, someone gets a diagnosis of cancer, God forbid, or anything, you know, everyone's got a meal train and they're doing this and da da da. And with an eating disorder, you don't get that. And when you were saying that, like, you know, bring the abuela in, bring the grandma in, you know, when your friends are asking, if you have anyone that's asking, I know a lot of people do not, how can I help? I mean, man, have them do a meal train to help. That would help so much because you get so sick of cooking, right? Yeah. So, you know, finding a community that can help you, you know, do some of that. That just sparked in
my mind. Can be really challenging for families who don't cook.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's okay. You don't actually have to cook. I worked with a family that did it all via takeout, literally even breakfast.
Yeah. And Trader Joe's, Aldi, like there's so many options. And I know finances can obviously are such a huge thing, but there are options that you can, you know, get some caloric stuff done being creative.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. And it's exhausting. It's exhausting. Yeah. And, you know, I think that these conversations of is this really working, these are conversations you need to have and trust that your team will tell you it's not working. And you need to know, what is my plan B? What is my plan C? Am I the right person? What I do find sometimes is that the meals all fall on one parent sometimes. And that can really be problematic. And oftentimes, just by making sure both parents are present, even for most of the meals, maybe not every single one, but if both parents can commit to maybe always being together for half of the meals, that makes a huge difference, because the one parent who's really doing 100% of the meals, they get burnt out and they need to rely on the support from the other parent. So sometimes just making a simple change like that can make a huge difference.
It's so good to talk about all the different ways that this can go. I think it normalizes just how much this is not a straight path. We always hear it's not linear, but this is really helping to illustrate it can go in just so many ways, and that doesn't mean it's not working. It can sometimes help to just kind of walk through like what maybe it looked like for someone. So I was wondering if you would share an example of a situation where you'd recommend that the family continues doing FBT, but that you do some of these twists with it.
Yeah, I have a family, and believe it or not, I'm still in touch with them. Every year they send me a picture of their daughter who's doing well. She graduated college now. And this family had a very kind of interesting immigration story. They were recent arrivals in the United States. Daughter developed an eating disorder, and both parents fully participated. And we brought in some meal support coaches for them because the kid was getting so dysregulated. And when the meal support coach was there, it calmed things down, and they got the food. And with the help of the coach for that first week or two, we just did it for the first week or two. They actually came to Miami, stayed in a hotel. We had a coach work with them so that they really felt confident in doing it. So I did the first meal, and the kid was like, oh, like, wow. You know how it is, like demon child. But having the coach there helped calm things down, gave them the confidence to keep going. And they developed that confidence with the coach to then go back home and do it. But they gave themselves time. They did like, I don't know, 15 meals with a coach, so that by the time they went back, they were really feeling like, I got it. And I think it's, you do. And the meal support coach has done this for like a decade. Like, she worked in a treatment center. She's seen this a million times. Watching someone throw a fit and spit out their food and cry did not ruffle her feathers. And
right. She's not emotional about it. It's not her kid. Right.
And so that's really helpful for the family to be able to do that. I mean, I can tell them that the next time I see them, like, that's going to happen. And right. But to have someone there with you to kind of ride that storm with you a bunch of times before you do it on your own, that can be really, really helpful. Not everybody can afford a meal support coach, but, you know, that can be really helpful. And that's a way we kind of mixed it up a little bit.
Ooh, that's a great example. Thanks for sharing that. I'm going to go with the opposite question. Maybe, and I'm putting you on the spot a little bit, but coming up with an example of a situation where you would recommend that they transition to a different treatment approach away from FBT, or would you?
Yeah, I mean, look, I definitely had cases where the FBT wasn't working, that the kid just, and again, this is another family I'm still in touch with, and the child's eating disorder was not caught for a long time because she was very tall. And she was an athlete, and they thought she had a heart problem. And so it was being treated like a medical issue, but it was because she was restricting and underweight and playing a lot of sports. And her mom is like the nicest woman, so sweet, but really had a hard time saying no. Really had a hard time laying down the law with the eating disorder. And this kid knew exactly how to push her mom's button. So we're going. Her weight's not getting better. Her weight's going down, blah, blah, blah. And finally, I always bring the child in first and have a meeting with them. And she said to me that she knew she was manipulating her mother. And it was making her angry. Mm-hmm. And I said, do you think you need to go to a higher level of care? And she said, I need you to tell my mom I need to go to a higher level of care. She said, my mom can't do this. And this was not a mom who was not trying. She's extremely likable, like sweet, polite, lovely. The father became a puddle every time he talked about the eating disorder. All he would do was cry. And so this kid, but again, part of that is that I built a relationship with that child where she was able to say it's true. And I kept saying to them, I don't think she has a heart problem. I think this is a nutrition problem. She does not have a heart problem anymore. She went to college. She's getting a degree in counseling now. But she knew it. Mm-hmm. And the mom was so frustrated, like, because I was like, look, she's not eating as much as you think she is if her weight continues to go down. And we've been, you know, here we are 2-3 months in, and we're spinning our wheels here. So, you know, in most cases where FBT didn't work out, you know, we had a systematic plan to refer the person to a higher level of care with a place worked out and sort of like, if we don't get this together, we're going to be going to a higher level of care. And sometimes that increases the motivation of everybody to make it work. And sometimes it can't, it doesn't work. And then my mind is always blown by families who've been doing it for like 2 years straight. So, you know, I know it happens for a lot of different reasons, but if you've been doing FBT nonstop for 12, 16, 19 months, time to reconsider for sure.
Yeah. That makes perfect sense. Perfect sense. And on that note, where do you see the future with your little crystal ball, Dr. Boyers? The future of the world. No, the future of FBT and treatment. Like, where do you see this going maybe 5 years from now, 10 years from now? We had that shift back in the 80s, you know, getting the parents out and then bringing them back in. Where do you see the trajectory going in the future?
I mean, I think there has been much more of a coming together. I think, you know, there was a time where FBT families like kind of like, you know, really didn't trust treatment centers. I think now there's much more of a recognition of the contribution of FBT to the field generally and of really bringing families in. And, you know, I see a lot of FBT-based programs that incorporate traditional components of residential treatment center too. And I think there's a recognition that sometimes people just need a little bit of everything. And I don't think FBT is going anywhere, and I don't think treatment centers are going anywhere. And I think what we're starting to see now is a little more creativity in the field around reaching populations that haven't always gotten particularly good quality care. There's better access now with virtual programs. And, you know, just there's people now coming up with a lot of, you know, different types of services that gives people more freedom and choice. But with that being said, I will say just because you have the ability to pay for some kind of concierge, very individualized treatment, doesn't mean it's better.
Yeah, exactly. You know, what do we say at the beginning, right? What's the best treatment for your kid?
Right. Just because you can buy it and control it and tell people how to deliver it doesn't mean that you're getting the best care. You really want to work with people who have ethics and guidelines and who will say no to you if they think that something you're asking them to do is not in the best interest of your loved one.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Would you be able to, Amy, just as we're wrapping up this episode, if there might be some parents that are in the middle of FBT and they're recognizing all these things that we're talking about, but maybe someone's right now trying to decide if they want to do FBT, what advice would you give the ones who are maybe about to start their FBT journey?
First of all, I would talk to whatever therapist you're working with and ask them, do you have a family that you could recommend that I speak to? Because I did that all the time. Oh. And I didn't match. I matched families that I thought were more similar to one another. So I would try to find, you know, if it was two working parents, I would try to find another family with two working parents. Because, you know, the experience, if one parent is at home and able to really do the work, that's going to be different than two parents who have to both work. How do you, So how do you navigate that? So I always tried to match them up. So ask someone who knows you and other families, can you have me talk to a family that you think I could relate to who did this with you so that I can learn more about it? Sometimes I even had other families come into the sessions to talk to the families about their experience. And I did that sometimes when they got stuck. I would bring the patient and their parents in to meet with another patient and parents. And so the parents would talk and then the two patients would talk to one another. So if one was recovered and one was struggling, I would bring them in because they were feeling very alone. So, you know, you want to work with someone who does this a lot, who can do stuff like that for you. And so what would help them consider that? I think you have to be very honest with yourself. This is a big undertaking and you have to know yourself. And you have to know what your strengths and weaknesses are. Nobody else is going to do that. You can't just do it because you were told to. You have to do it because you, in your heart, believe that this is the best way for your child and your family to heal. And you have to be fully committed. And if that doesn't feel right to you, that's fine. That's great. Let's explore options that are more appropriate for you, that are going to allow you to be the best you can be in supporting your child. So yes, I want to be involved in my child's care, but I don't think I can handle this. For whatever reason, people have lots of reasons why. I don't think, maybe it's just this moment in time in my life. Maybe it's me, I know me. Maybe there's other stressors going on that I have to be aware of. Whatever it may be, how involved can I be in my child's care? How much am I going to be able to participate in treatment? Not just visit your kid, but participate in treatment. How do I feel when I'm talking to them? So, you know, there's lots of ways to get there, but I think at the end of the day, it's being very quiet with yourself and being so, so, so honest and really listening to yourself. And you can start and give it a try, and you can also stop. Like, it's not going to be the end of the world if it doesn't work. And you might surprise yourself. It might not be as bad as you think it is.
And you can do it, and you can have setbacks and get right back on the saddle again. And yeah, we're definitely capable of more than we think we can do. And it doesn't need to be perfect.
No, it's not going to be. It's really messy in the beginning.
Messy.
Very, very, very hard. It takes a long time. I mean, I always tell parents, like, you're having to do what an entire team of people do in a treatment center all by yourself. And we all like went to school for this and you didn't.
Yep.
So it's going to take a while to get the knowledge and the skills to deal with it. But it sends a very strong message to your child and to the eating disorder that I am willing to roll up my sleeves and show up for this, that this is going to end. This is not going to stay this way.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah. That's great. A really powerful way to end this episode, Amy. Laura and I really want to give you a huge thank you for being here and sharing all of your wisdom with us and your insights with our listeners. We're really, really grateful that you spent this time with us and shared your work with us.
That was fun. Thank you so much. I'm so glad. I hope it's helpful to people, and I hope it's some good food for thought, as they say.
I know it definitely will be.
Thank you.
And our next episode will be joined by Hannah Hickenbotham from the UK, who is going to share her powerful and inspirational journey with an eating disorder. She's bringing the perspective of someone who's recovered, so I know all of the caregivers will find her story informative and hopeful, and we hope you'll join us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us at The Other Side of the Plate. If today's episode gave you hope or guidance, we invite you to explore more resources and peer support at feast-ed.org. Remember, you are never alone. For more conversations of hope and help for families facing eating disorders, please join us for our next episode.